Mark Twain writes of his little daughter who was having a very bad day because she had broken a toy and a picnic that had been planned in the neighborhood was canceled because of rain, and she was crying, and her mother rather impatiently said, darling, you mustn't cry about little things. And she said, Mama, what is little things? A lot of the things that are little to us may be very important to a child or someone else. And so I would guess that what is big and little to some degree is relative to the person and the situation. But the Bible does speak of many things that are little. And I'm inclined to think that so much of our lives is not the big momentous events, although there are those things that change the direction of our lives and that for many things occur only once in our lives. But the great bulk of our experiences are the tremendous number of little things that occur in our lives. And it is that day-by-day illustration and experience in doing God's will, the minutiae of life, that occupies so very much of our time. And so tonight I want to study with you some of the things. There is so much in the Scripture that deals with little things. I want you to notice at the beginning that little things may teach very big lessons, and that will be illustrated, I think, in our lesson as we look at some Old Testament and New Testament examples of very little things that teach very big lessons in God's sight. And we are reminded that the Lord Himself taught that the individual who is faithful in that which is least or little may become faithful also in much. And those people who are employers often look at how their employees deal with little things and little situations rather than just the big things. And if we overlook the little things, how often the big things are also overlooked. In the Old Testament, the book of Proverbs, particularly, and I was reminded of this a couple of classes ago in Brad's class as we studied about the little things that I'll be reading about, details the work of some little creatures. And then in the New Testament, I want to look at illustrations from the life of Jesus as he spoke of the lilies of the field, of the sparrows of the air, and the value of even a cup of cold water. You have noticed, no doubt, that the songs that Harold has led us in just now are about those things, and that we have already sung lessons about little things that we may do, and that there is room in the kingdom of God for all of us and all of the little things that we may do in the Lord's service. Our lives certainly are profoundly influenced by little things. First, in the book of Proverbs, the proverb writer writes in chapter 30 there, that there are four things that are little upon the earth, but that are exceedingly wise. The ants are a people not strong, yet they prepare their meat in the summer. The conies are but a feeble folk, yet they make their houses in the rocks. The locusts have no king, yet they go forth, all of them, by bands. The spider taketh hold with her hands and is in king's palaces. I want you to notice each of those and lessons that will help us as we attempt to live for the Lord in our daily life. Notice the little ant. The ant teaches diligent preparation. Over in the book of Proverbs in chapter 6, he talks about the ant and lessons that we will learn from that little creature. And as tiny as it is, here are things that the Lord notices and that the Lord reveals to us about that. He teaches against laziness and slothfulness. Beginning at verse 6 in Proverbs 6, go to the ant, thou sluggard. Consider her ways and be wise, which, having no guide or overseer or ruler, provideth her meat in the summer and gathereth her food in the harvest. He says in these verses that we can be wise if we observe this tiny little creature and see how diligently the ant is constantly busy and working. And here is preparation that is being made. There is an instinct within that little creature to provide for the future. for a time when food will not be so available, and that there will be a need for that which has been stored up. And we learn the lesson, if we are wise, even from this little creature, that we must work now, that there is a time and a place when we should work, and that if we fail to do that, the time will come when we'll not be able to make that same preparation. In the 8th chapter of the book of Jeremiah, verse 20, Jeremiah laments that the harvest is past, the summer is ended, and you're not saved. The time is past when that nation might have made a turn toward God, and they did not. And so timing, sometimes people say, is everything, and that is an oversimplification. But the time to do something is when we have that opportunity. When we have the ability and the opportunity, we have the responsibility. And we ought to work while we can. In the book of Ecclesiastes, chapter 12 and verse 1, that application of that principle is made in reference to that period of our life that we call youth. Remember now thy Creator in the days of thy youth, while the evil days come not, nor the years draw nigh, when thou shalt say, I have no pleasure in them. How many people look back and wish that they had obeyed the gospel in youth? How many people realize that if I had done this at that particular time, how much better my life would have been? How many people wish that they had not had sinful experiences that they came to have in their lives, that they had given their lives earlier in their existence to the Lord? And so the ant teaches that we should work, and that we should work now, because the time comes when those same opportunities will not be available. And Paul writes to the Galatians in chapter 6 and verse 10, and says, as we have therefore opportunity, let us do good unto all men, and especially unto those who are the household of faith. There are opportunities all around us. And in the songs that we have just sung, that is certainly taught, that a small kindly deed, how many times have you thought, oh, I wish I'd have said something. I wish I had said, or I wish I had given, or I wish I had been there. And that opportunity passes, and we do not have it again. And so this little creature teaches us that wonderful lesson. Jesus, in John the 9th chapter in verse 4, said, I must work the works of him that sent me while it is day. The night cometh when no man can work. And so Jesus realized that even in his life, he is the Son of God. But he recognizes that there was a time, and that he must do what he must do at that time. And in that circumstance and with those people, there is a timing that we must observe. And the ant, that tiny creature, teaches that. The Bible reveals in connection with that, that the storage that the ant uses is secure. And similarly, we are to understand that the work that we do, that there is a way to secure that which is eternal. Jesus admonishes that we do not lay up our treasures on the earth, but we lay up our treasures in heaven, where neither moth and rust corrupt, and where thieves do not break through nor steal. In those verses, he says, you must use the time and opportunity that you have in order to secure for yourselves treasures in heaven. And you could spend a lot of time meditating upon that. But all of those things come to us, and probably other lessons, from this tiny little creature. The conies were a little folk, a weak folk, the Bible says in the passage I read. And they are kind of like little rabbits, I think of them. I think one translation calls them the rock badger. And so a tiny little creature that if it were out here by itself would have little chance of surviving. But God has placed in that tiny creature an instinct to secure a sure refuge. And so the thing that the coney does best is to hide in the rocks. And it will come out, and it will get food, and it will do what it must do. But then it scurries back under the rocks. There is a sense within it that there must be protection. It is very good for us to consider that and to realize that we should look for refuge In the book of Isaiah, chapter 28, verse 16, Isaiah pointed the people to a place of refuge. Behold, I lay in Zion for a foundation, a stone, a tried stone, a precious cornerstone, a sure foundation. He that believeth shall not be made, shall not make haste. In that passage, which is messianic, he points to Jesus as the sure refuge for our lives. There is so much that we cannot accomplish on our own. In fact, there is very little. And our constant and absolute dependence upon the Lord and our recognition that it is His will and His work and the refuge that He provides that we are to seek in all of our efforts is a very important lesson for us to learn. And our helplessness in the face of all of the things that Satan may hurl at us and all the circumstances of life, when we think about the sure refuge, the solid rock on which we stand, that ought to give us great comfort. And this little creature teaches us that we should look for refuge. And the realization that we need help, Jeremiah wrote, O Jehovah, I know that the way of man is not in himself. It is not in man that walketh to direct himself, his steps. You know, just the realization that not only do I need refuge and help every day, but that often I do not even know exactly what it is I need. And that I recognize that I cannot order my steps, that I must depend upon God, is a very important thing for Christians to realize. If I can realize my constant and absolute dependence upon the Lord and my trust in His providential care and the fact that He will show me through His will and through His providential care the path that I should take is a wonderful, comforting thought. And this little creature teaches us that we have one that we can trust for that. So many passages speak of God as our refuge, many more. I'm sure that you can think of others, even as I mention a couple here. In the 33rd chapter of the book of Deuteronomy, these familiar words, the eternal God is our refuge, and underneath are the everlasting arms. We sing a song about that, don't we? What a fellowship. What a joy divine, leaning upon the everlasting arms. And so here, though the arm of flesh may fail, are arms that will never fail us in every circumstance, in every situation. Our God's protection, His everlasting arms are promised for us. In the 94th Psalm, verse 22, the Lord is my defense and my God is the rock of my refuge. If you look at the surrounding verses of that particular verse in that psalm, you will see that that is one of those psalms where the psalmist talks about all of his enemies and their characteristics. And he does so in beautiful poetic language and describes how fierce they are and how ingenious they are in getting at him. David had so many enemies and so many problems in his life. But here he realizes that there is a refuge and He is the rock of my refuge and in Him I can take my defense. What a marvelous thing that this great man of God came to realize that. And how blessed we are to have His words that we might realize that our strength and confidence comes from Jehovah. There is a strange creature in this. I guess all of them are unusual, but this one I think is especially strange in some of the things that are said about the locusts. It is said of the locusts that these locusts go forth in bands, and what they accomplish because they work with others. And what a lesson that is for us. In thinking about the literal devastation that locusts may work in their devastation. Over in the book of Exodus, chapter 10, there is the example of the plague that involved locusts that God sent through the hand of Moses and Aaron upon the Egyptians. And it is said of these locusts in verses 14 and 15, they went up over all the land of Egypt and rested in all the coasts of Egypt. Very grievous were they. Before them there were no such locusts as they, neither after them shall be such. And so these were evidently some species, some unusual variety of locusts that were especially voracious in their appetite. For they covered the face of the whole earth so that the land was darkened. So many of them that it was like the land was darkened with their sheer numbers. And they did eat every herb of the land and all the fruit of the trees, which the hail, that was another plague that had been visited upon the Egyptians. And there remained not any green thing in the trees or in the herbs of the field through all the land of Egypt. And so an individual locust wouldn't eat very much. A thimbleful, half a cup full, I don't know how much they would eat in a whole day. But there were so many of them, each doing his part, as it were, like a mighty army side by side, covering every inch of the ground and the vegetation and everything that was before them. They ate so that the land behind them was bare. They accomplished what they accomplished through unity and cooperation. What a lesson for the people of God. How much we can accomplish when we work together, when each one does his part, each one does his little bit and fulfills with his ability that God has given him that which is right in front of him. What a lesson for us. Our deacon selection process came to mind, and the fact that we have these men who are willing to serve in such a variety of ways and in very quiet ways often, and hardly recognized or mentioned only on certain occasions maybe. But here are individuals who are willing to work and dedicate many hours of their lives and their talents and their time so that they may accomplish work for this congregation. And all working together, how much they are able to accomplish. And we, as members of this church, are benefactors of their work. And so here is work and unity and cooperation. But not just the work of elders and deacons and preachers and so on. But every Christian is to do what he or she must do. We are to use our individual talents and abilities and opportunities in the service of God. And when we do that, the whole earth will benefit. And every community where there are congregations of Christians will be blessed by those people who are the salt of the earth and the light of the world. And so let each of us realize that the part that is right before us, that is what we are to do. And with the help of God, in great numbers, that we shall accomplish much in His service. When we think about the harmony and the work that people can do, churches can accomplish so much when they are all working, when the people are all working toward the same end, when each one is trying to do his part faithfully and without fanfare, just to do what we can do, each of us, in the service of God. These locusts are said to have no king. And I don't know just exactly what that means. I know that among some creatures that God has made that there are leaders, and you see the geese going overhead, and you see that one is out front, and I understand the little sounds that are being made or signals, and the others are following in that beautiful formation in the sky. But the locusts have no king. Whatever that means, it means that each one has within him that instinct given by his Creator to do what he must do right in front of you. We are more fortunate in that we have the leadership of King Jesus. We have one who has gone before us. We see Jesus, who was made a little lower than the angels for the suffering of death, crowned with glory and honor, that he, by the grace of God, should taste death for every man. And so he has paved the way before us. He has been the trailblazer and the pioneer. He has shown us in his life what it is to live completely for God. And so we walk in his steps and imitate his blessed example, so that we, in following Jesus, we follow our king and our leader. When you look at these little creatures, maybe the most strange one that God would introduce in this is the spiders. And just to mention that is not to bring pleasant thoughts for most people. But the spiders certainly illustrate, and the proverb writer mentions this in a roundabout way, that the spider takes hold, that wherever the spider is, that little creature figures out a way to build a web. And because of that, the spider is able to have, by his method, his spider web and habitation everywhere. And the record even says it's in the palaces of kings. Isn't that interesting? Many of you have visited palaces, and you know what splendid structures they are where royalty lives. But I am so sure that when the Queen of England decides to go to Balmoral or Holyrood or back to Buckingham Palace, that there's a crew of people who goes ahead of her and checks those royal apartments in those palaces to be sure that there are no spiders. Someone has to carefully inspect and be sure, because here is a little creature that lacks royal residences also. And though that creature has nothing in this world's goods, it knows what to do. And so it takes hold and is in king's palaces. What a lesson for us. I was taught with that very expression as a child. My father many times would say, take hold. Or in this or that job or situation or challenge, son, take hold. And I came to realize that means grab whatever is in front of you and do the task, do the work. Don't stand around waiting for advantageous event to occur, but just take hold. And right before you to do what needs to be done, there is a wonderful illustration in that. And if the spider fails, it tries again. You all know that. Unless you destroy that little creature, you can destroy the spider's web, and guess what? The next day it'll be there again, won't it? Because when that's torn down, it just builds another. It tries again. And there is a lesson for us even in that. Jesus taught in Matthew chapter 24, verse 12, beginning, that because iniquity shall abound, the love of many shall wax cold, but he that endureth to the end, the same shall be saved. And so Jesus said, you got to endure. You got to keep trying. That you cannot give up because of sin. And all of us, I have the devastation of sin from time to time, and we look back and we say, how foolish. How could I have said that or done that or neglected to do this? And I can see it so clearly now, but at the moment, I yielded to this pressure or that temptation or to the influence of someone else. And so we recognize that we must try and try again. And we must rebuild again and again and again. And congregations, and particularly the leadership in congregations, must encourage people along this line. Many of the things I am sure that our elders deal with are failures in the lives of individuals, mistakes that are made, trials that must be overcome, situations that must be redone and rethought. And so the course correction that is being done is a constant and steadfast thing. And that is true not only in their leadership toward us, but each of us, as we examine our consciences and our lives, realize I need to improve on this, or I need to do better with that. I need to be more inclusive in these prayers, and so on. And so the need to constantly try and try again. In Revelation chapter 2 and verse 10, be thou faithful unto death, and I will give thee the crown of life. Jesus taught, and you have been taught, that unto the point of death, that as long as we live, as long as we have that erg of life and energy in us, that we are to keep trying. And that is just a part of our work in the Christian life. And the little spider, tiny as it is, teaches that. But quickly, I want to look to some New Testament examples. Jesus talked about the lilies of the field. I love this illustration. In the 12th chapter of Luke, verses 27 and 28, he said, consider, look at the lilies of the field. I understand. Many scholars believe, most scholars I think that I have read, believe that this was the tiny bloom that would come after a rain on a desert place. And it was almost overnight that the little flowers would spring up. The seed was there. The little bulb was there all of the time. And it only took the moisture. The heat was there. And so it would quickly spring up and bloom in a beautiful way. Some of you have lived in the desert, and I've heard people talk about how marvelous it is in those parts of our country where the rain will bring out a carpet of flowers almost, and that everywhere there is beauty. Well, Jesus said, consider the lilies of the field, how they grow. They toil not, neither do they spin. And yet I say unto you that Solomon in all of his glory was not arrayed like one of these. And then he says, if God, beloved, bestows such love and comfort on the grass of the field, which today is and tomorrow is cast into the oven, shall he not much more clothe you, O ye of little faith? What a lesson for us that God would bestow such beauty, such an abundance of beauty. There are flowers that bloom where no eye will ever see them. That is just the way God does it. And so everywhere there's evidence of the beauty of God's creation. And he does all of that. And we can learn a lesson from that. His goodness, his love that we studied this morning is so abundant that words fail us to try to fathom and talk about such love that has been manifested. And so he is so generous and giving as he bestows beauty on the earth. And so the illustration is well taken for us. The lesson is so clear. If God bestows such care and such beauty upon that which lasts for a few hours, for a day, will he not take care of us? Why, of course, he will care for us. And so he remonstrates about the smallness of our faith because God is so great and even with the lily of the field bestows such a blessing. The sparrows are a case in point. Jesus, in the 10th chapter of the book of Matthew, spoke of maybe the most common bird there is. There are beautiful and exotic birds that are worth a great deal of money. And where the plumage is so beautiful, it just takes our breath away. But then there's the sparrow. And though it is a pest in many places, it is everywhere. And God uses that creature to illustrate an important truth. In these verses that I've listed for you, verse 29, he says, are not two sparrows sold for a farthing, a tiny coin, worth practically nothing? And yet he says, one of them shall not fall on the earth, but that without your Father. And then he says two verses later, you are worth more than many sparrows. Jesus is teaching the lesson that God is very aware of the tiniest things in our lives. He knows every need. He knows the nuances of our lives. He understands completely how a God so great with billions of people who live on the earth could have such infinite detail in his concern for us staggers our imagination. And yet he does. And so God loves you and loves me. And he knows all about us, our thoughts, our words, our imaginations. He understands the impulses that drive us day by day. And so here is a God who is so concerned about everything in your life and mine. And he loves us and he provides for us. Consider the sparrows. Not even one can fall without his knowledge. And so don't you know that he cares for us? He cares for us completely and absolutely and in every detail of our lives. Well, the final thing I want to mention is a cup of cold water. And here we move from little creatures and flowers to tiny actions. And I do believe our master teacher has picked the cheapest and most common thing in this world to illustrate the point that he wants to make. In Matthew chapter 10, verse 42, he says, "Whosoever shall give to drink unto one of these little ones a cup of cold water only in the name of a disciple, verily I say unto you, he shall in no wise lose his reward." And so we serve a great God. We serve a God who sees even when the most simple things, things we do not hardly think about as we offer it, are important in his sight. That even to give a cup of cold water under the right circumstances is to be noticed by the Lord and to be rewarded by him. Well, there are practical applications, and we've tried to make some as we've gone along. There's an old song, and I don't believe it's in our book, Harold, that says, "Little is much if God is in it." And if God is involved in the act, though it may be a small kindly deed, a word that will cheer another, as we sang about, a cup of cold water, a smile and encouragement, you go on with the list. All of those things are very important in the sight of God. And so little creatures and little plants, little acts are important ways to see the hand of God and to do his work in this world. And we're involved in that. And every one of us can do more and turn our attention to all the tiny things that make up the bulk of our lives and use all of those things in the service of the Master. I want to read as we close our lesson from Matthew chapter 25, and it is familiar to you because it is the basis of judgment, in this particular picture of judgment at least, when the Son of Man shall come in his glory and all his holy angels with him. Then shall he sit upon the throne of his glory, and before him shall be gathered all nations, and he shall separate them, the one from the other, as a shepherd divides his sheep from the goats. And he shall set the sheep on his right hand, but the goats on the left. Then shall the king say to those on his right hand, "Come, ye blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. I was hungry, and you gave me meat. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you took me in. Naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came unto me." Then shall the righteous answer, "Lord, when saw we thee a hungered and fed thee, or thirsty and gave thee drink? When saw we thee a stranger and took thee in, or naked and clothed thee? And when saw we thee sick or in prison and came unto thee?" The king shall answer and say unto them, "Verily I say unto you, inasmuch as you have done it unto one of the least of these, my brethren, you've done it unto me." You want to serve Christ? There are opportunities all around you. There are people here in this room. There are people whom you will greet before you leave tonight that you can be a blessing to. I was intrigued as a young preacher more than 50 years ago when someone asked me, I had not been at this place very long, Carolyn and I hadn't, and someone said, "Have you visited Brother Willie and Ms. Oz?" I said, "No, I don't know them." They told me where they lived. It wasn't far from our building. It was in a little house on a hill about where the interstate now crosses into Tennessee. And he greeted me at the door, and we had not talked but a minute or two, and he said, "Come and see Ms. Oz." I suppose that was a short name for some other name. I never remembered knowing any other name. But we went into a bedroom, and she was bedfast, and she was a tiny little lady. But I was struck immediately by how very clean that room was and how everything looked just right, and she smiled as he came in. And I could tell in just a minute that her mind was about gone. I said, Brother Willie, do you take care of her yourself? And he said, yes. He said, she's a tiny thing, and I can just pick her up, and I treat her like a baby. And his whole conversation was about how he took care of her. It was not many weeks later that I was there on a Sunday afternoon in a similar visit when she slipped from this life. We were standing there, and he told me when I came to the door that her breathing was very weak, and so she passed away. And he gently closed her eyes, and I said, Brother Willie, would you like to pray? And I prayed, and we stood there by the bed, and I thanked God that he had served Christ as he had in taking care of Ms. Oz. Do you believe he was serving Christ? I had preached a sermon and taught a Bible class, but he was there serving Christ and taking care of her. And that is how so much of our service to Christ is. It is not so much the public things that people might notice, but it is in that myriad of daily little things as we speak kind words and as we encourage and as we tell people of Jesus. And as we do those things, indeed, we are serving Christ.